Welcome to the Agriculture Podcast again, two episodes in a row, 2 days in a row, I should say. And today I'm talking with Lisa Peterson. She is a livestock specialist for Extension. And today we're going to talk about cattle, obviously, and a little less about drought. Drought has been such the focus lately whenever I talk to anybody, whether it's about livestock or crops. So we're going to shift gears a bit and talk about some other issues in the livestock industry pertaining to cattle. But Lisa, just to start out with, give me a bit of your background and, you know, how you came to work and love the cattle industry. I know you're really busy getting ready for the fair, so I really appreciate you taking your time to talk with me today.
No, that's not a problem at all. This is an important part of our jobs. And so I was raised on a cow-calf, actually pretty diversified livestock operation in very southwest Colorado near the town of Durango. And we had a registered Hereford operation along with a commercial Hereford operation, a range and farm flock of sheep, and then a confinement hog operation. And when I say confinement, it's not in the confinement barns like you see today, but all of our pigs were on concrete, but they were in open air. And so I was raised in a pretty diversified place with most of our major species minus dairy. We occasionally had a milk cow, but certainly I would never consider ourselves a dairy. And of course, horses as well. We always had horses. And, you know, my mom was a home ec agent and an extension. That's what they called themselves back then. And she was as well versed in agriculture as most ag agents. But back in the day, women were not ag agents. They were home ec agents. And she had shown several champion steers in Denver at the stock show and at the international and at the Royal, but women just didn't go into agriculture back then. And so I was kind of born and bred to be in agriculture and in extension. I've always loved this industry. My parents were always really active in the industry beyond just farming and ranching, but in our allied industry associations, as you know, the local cattlemen, state cattlemen, the national cattlemen, and the same on when I was growing up, they were the cowbells, but the cattle women. And, you know, I was raised that servant leadership is one of the things that we do in our lives. We give back to the industries and to our communities in a servant manner. And that has really stuck with me. And so we really try to follow that model at our place. I'm currently married to a rancher. I call a Dakota's mixed marriage. And that is that I work in North Dakota during the week for NDSU Extension. My appointment is with the Central Grasslands Research Extension Center near Streeter. But on the weekends, my husband and I ranch, and he's here during the week at our ranch, Broken Heart Ranch, near Firesteel, South Dakota. And we have a daughter, and we're fortunate that she is able to stay with him on the ranch and that his folks help out with her as well. And so, you know, I kind of live that life, and we certainly enjoy giving back to our industry as well. And, you know, I live my life for our producers. You know, cattle are the predominant species in the Dakotas. But, you know, and then especially in North Dakota, the producers who I serve. But we really love these industries, and I really appreciate the opportunity to serve our producers, to help them, to teach with them, to be their shoulder to lean on, and, you know, give back as much as possible to our youth and our adults.
Yeah, giving back is so important. And I want to stress education is so important, you know, as stewards of livestock in the land. It's really important. But just to touch on, you know, your comment about what it was like for your mom to work in extension back in those days. It's actually true that in the agriculture industry, women are taking over much faster than they are in any other industry. So fun fact, and I think about 30% of farm operators are women.
So yes, that's true.
Yes. And so I have to ask, you know, you guys raised Herefords as you were, you know, as a kid, what color are your cows now?
So I married a registered and commercial Red Angus operation. Chad's family are one of the three or four oldest Red Angus breeders in the country. And So one day we will have a certified Hereford here, but our cows are red. And so we over the years at this operation had crossbred, but then we lost some lease. And so we had to sell some of those cows. And so we've lost that crossbreeding, but when we were crossbreeding, they generally bred those cows to Charolais bulls. And you know, I think most people would think that that's a terminal cross, but at the end of the day, some of our finest females were those buckskin cows and heifers. And so it was a really nice cross. And it is a goal of ours that if we can expand our herd size in the years to come, that we would, again, either utilize a more British cross with probably Hereford or even Shorthorn. You know, the Durham Red is a beautiful cow, and it's one that I think we've lost a lot of in this country. So either Shorthorn or Hereford. And then if we did the terminal thing, I think it would probably be with Charolais, to be honest.
Okay, interesting. So what do you think, in your opinion, what's the biggest issue you currently see in the cattle industry?
I don't know that there's a single biggest, but I think when we get beyond our struggles with drought, I really see a lot of this generation transfer still being a huge issue. And in our, I don't really love to talk politics in our job, but you know, it comes through in everything that we do. And in the past administration, we had gotten some relief from estate taxes in agriculture. And, you know, people say, well, you know, whatever that, I think it's $10 million, upper limit is, that's a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money, but you know what? Most agricultural operations today easily have that in assets between land, equipment, buildings, in terms of livestock operations, livestock. And so it doesn't take long to hit $10 million. And, so I think really and truly, it is still a major issue. And then if we happen to lose this adjusted basis, it's going to be even a bigger issue for our operations. And so I really, the challenges I hear from producers on a day in and day out basis oftentimes come with farm family issues. You know, you got two families working together, three families, ag transfer issues. I hear it almost every day that mom and dad thought that every kid deserved the same, but there was always a kid or two who stayed home and put all of their efforts into the farm and didn't take much out of it. And they're stuck having to pay off their siblings and what their siblings think is an inflated rate. And so I just think that we cannot lose sight of those issues. And I think our operations would be far more resilient if we looked forward 30 years instead of back 30 years and how we're going to transfer these operations, and then realize that those transfers are not a stationary thing. They're very fluid, and you need to look at them pretty often and make sure that they can still function in the regulatory environment and maybe the family environment that they're built on. I mean, families are pretty fluid too today. And, you know, I've probably been chided for saying this a time or two, but, you know, I actually even recommend to young people that are coming back to operations that maybe if they are marrying into or they are marrying somebody into their operation, they even need to think about some prenups in those things. And not because anybody ever thinks they're going to get divorced, but you don't know what the long term can be. And beyond, you know, if there's a death in the family and you get remarried and those people stay together, I mean, there's just all kinds of complications. And so I think that there's some of that that we need to think about as well, because really it comes down to the fact that our ag businesses are truly businesses, and we don't always operate our farms and ranches like businesses, but we got to start doing it. And, you know, some tough times in prices and drought are really bringing that forward to us. And then, so that'd be number one. Number two is that I think we really need to start building some resiliency into our operations. I really feel bad for a lot of our producers that are fighting drought, but even in the worst parts of drought, I find operators that aren't too concerned because they have built drought resiliency into their operations. And, you know, when we get another year or two into drought, I think that they're going to be concerned, but they're still going to be far ahead of some of these other operations. So building some financial resiliency, building drought resiliency, building genetic resiliency, management resiliency into your operation, and not just always operating for maximum, but maybe operating more for optimum, I think it'd be a good thing. And then, you know, I think we really need to start looking at stewardship, not only stewardship of livestock. I think we actually do a pretty good job of that day in and day out, but overall stewardship. And, you know, whether as producers we want to be at the table or not and want to be part of the conversation, the sustainability, and I prefer to call it stewardship, but that piece is going to be in our back door for a long time. And it goes back far beyond our gates. You know, this is something that came out many years ago that we had to limit carbon capture. And so even the equity firms in this country are only providing equity to places that have a carbon footprint plan and decreasing carbon emissions, and including in the beef industry and in the livestock industry. And that's what's really driving it. And, you know, it's easy to blame somebody that's just down the road in your industry, but really and truly, this is a national issue. And that's one of the reasons why North Dakota's, you know, being hammered on pretty hard in terms of fossil fuels, whether it's coal or oil or gas. And I think it's something that in agriculture we need to be proactive with. You know, at NDSU and other entities across the country, we are doing a lot of research that shows that animals, particularly ruminants and cattle, are really carbon sequestering creatures. And maybe yes, we're not the emissions animals that we thought. And I think that if we are proactive, we can end up having a positive gain in this instead of a negative gain. But we've got to be at the table and we just can't fight. We've got to be very proactive in that.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the EPA says themselves, livestock production is responsible for only 2% of those emissions. So I think it's, we could definitely be negative. Absolutely.
Yes, and our industry, you know, I guess if I had to add one last thing, our industry needs to come together. You know, I hear it from our legislative delegation in DC, but we are not a big enough industry to be fighting amongst each other. And these activist type groups really, I think, play devil's advocate in that they like to drive a wedge amongst each other. And they're the ones who win in this deal. You know, I hear on the show side of our industry that nobody wants to go back to Denver because of whatever for the National Western Stock Show. And I think to myself, do you guys really know how badly you are shooting the beef cattle industry in this country by not doing that? Because you have allowed an activist group to basically drive another wedge into the beef industry, into Colorado, another stake, another nail into it. And when we all stand together and say, by gosh, this show's important, it shows them that, you know what, the livestock industry in Colorado is important too. And, you know, we might think up here in Colorado or in North Dakota, that doesn't really matter to us. But you look at the packing capacity and the feeding capacity in Colorado, and it's a major issue. And if we lose those, it's a major issue for our whole industry. So I think we need to come together and, you know, get along at the table instead of just always wanting to be on the fight. And that's in all sides and all parts of our industry.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like you said, you've got these cattle groups fighting amongst themselves over here, and you've got activists and, you know, folks in Washington over here making stuff happen while we argue about, you know, things that might not necessarily be that important.
Absolutely. In the big picture, they're not that important. And, exactly. You know, I know that there are things that we're passionate about, but, you know, my dad told me one time there's hills to die on and hills to fight for. And I think we've got to decide which ones we want to die on and which ones aren't important. And we've got to look beyond some of this petty stuff that's going on in our industry and really look and see what's going on the big side, because I guarantee you, the activist groups, the anti-animal ag groups, they're just laughing. And quite frankly, my friends in the pork and poultry industry laugh at us too, because they always say that if we got along like they do, we would be unstoppable. We wouldn't even have hardly a pork and poultry industry in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to skip back a little bit, what does drought resiliency look like to you on a cattle operation?
So my observations in operations that really are coming through this drought, at least in the beginning periods, but I think even longer into it, a little stronger and not maybe having the same issues. For one thing, they carry over hay and a lot of it. And another thing is that instead of grazing, instead of maximizing their stocking rate, they optimize their stocking rate. And so, I would say year in and year out, they're probably somewhere around 80% of their grazing capacity instead of at 110%. And, you know, North Dakota and the Dakotas as a whole have been pretty blessed the last 20 years with a lot of moisture. And so, you know, I think we probably tend to overgraze anyway, but when you have a lot of moisture, you just kind of add more and add more and add more, right? And I understand why, because the more cows that you run, it really decreases your fixed costs. But sometimes we are running far too many for what our natural resources can manage. And you don't see that until you hit tough times, right? And so I think looking at your grazing operation, I also think building in a little bit of flexibility in your production. And so something that these operations tend to do is that they tend to have like a yearling enterprise in their operation. They maybe develop some heifers to sell, but some things that, you know, are pretty flexible and easy to get rid of instead of having to get rid of their core herd of cows. And then they always keep such good records. You know, some of these guys, I kind of giggle because they call and they say, well, which cows do you think I should get rid of? And I ask them what their records are. Well, they know by their records which cows to get rid of. And, you know, some people call me and they are just wholesale getting rid of every cow that's over 7, when in reality there's, you know, probably a percentage of every age group of cows that could easily go and would be more profitable to go for an operation. And so those tend to be the hallmarks of things that I see within those operations. And, you know, to me, the people who are really thinking about having to sell cows that are early, that are in some stress early in this drought period, they don't carry over hay. In fact, I kind of chuckle a little bit that some of them were selling hay last year. And you know, we live in a place where hay is pretty easy to carry over for the most part. And so, you know, building some of that resilience, and, you know, they also have, I think, some financial resilience built in, and they tend to be the operations that maybe don't have a new tractor, a new pickup, a new whatever every year, but, you know, they bankroll some of that money to get them through the tough days too.
Yeah. So plan for the unplanned is what we could sum all of that up into, I'd say.
My favorite quote is plan for the worst and hope for the best. And they tend to do that, right?
Yep, exactly. So I know you work with the Beef Quality Assurance Program. That's kind of your focus, right?
Yeah, it's one of my passions, yes.
Yes. So can you tell me how that has positively influenced the cattle industry?
Well, you know, in 1995 or 6, we had the worst consumer demand for beef that we've ever had. Mm-hmm. And it happened to coincide that at that period of time, 2 out of every 3 steaks consumers bought, quote unquote, did not eat right. And consumers went on to say that given the choice to purchase that steak again, somewhere around 75% would not do that. That's not a good thing for the industry. When your consumer doesn't want to repurchase what you have, you are in deep pile of trouble. And so, you know, Beef Quality Assurance was really, it's a program that's been around for, since the early 80s. And it started out as a residue avoidance program for animal health products. And because at the time there were some residue issues, and because of this program, we have really, you know, we have very, 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 very low level of residues in this country. And so we started looking, the industry started looking at what are some other things that were going on. Well, at that time, we were also giving all of our injections in the hind quarter. Why wouldn't you? It's the easiest place to give them, right?
Yep.
And so research identified that every time you stick a needle in an animal, you decrease the tenderness in an area up to 3 inches, which is about the size of a volleyball. So that would be most of our cuts of meat. And, you know, sirloins were the recipient of that decreased tenderness because that's where we gave all those shots in the top butt. And so we were really gutting the value and the consistency of one of our most tender cuts in the carcass. And so by moving those injections to the neck, we really improved the tenderness of beef. And then those initial audits also showed where our industry was in terms of quality grade and yield grade. And, you know, we were at the very worst in terms of percent choice about that time as well. And so the industry laid out some targets for improving quality grade along the way. And the industry has continually made those. And, you know, BQA cannot take full credit for that. I think a lot of these branded beef companies and even selling cattle on a grid has really changed that because, you know what, you get paid for a higher quality grade for hitting those targets. And now we know today that with BQA messaging, the acceptability of beef from consumers goes up. And so consumers feel more confident in the product that they buy. And when they put their money where their mouth is, they tend to buy that product at a higher price and more often. And so that is what's really driving the requirement for BQA certification in by packers of our fed cattle. And that started a lot with Wendy's. Wendy's understood that if they only bought BQA certified ground beef for their hamburgers, that they would increase the demand for their product. And it has worked that way because they utilize that BQA messaging.
Yeah, so, at the restaurant level, consistency is so important.
It is. And, you know, our consumers today, I think it's somewhere around a percent, percent and a half, were actually raised on farms and ranches. And we are to the day at the point in this country where people don't even remember going back to grandma and grandpa's farm and seeing cattle. And so our handshake, unfortunately, doesn't mean a whole lot in this world with a consumer. They want to see it on paper. They want to know that this is how it is. And so when our industry has laid out these standards for how we care for our animals, how we produce our animals, produce our beef, it really strengthens that consumer trust in us.
Yeah, it's so important. So let's talk about RFID. This is a controversial topic, especially amongst producers. So can you first just define what an RFID is?
So RFID stands for radio frequency identification. If you look at feedlot cattle, lots of times purebred cattle, all the cattle from a place like Michigan where they're fighting TB, you'll see round button tags typically is what they look like. And they're usually deep in the ear and they have a radio transmitter within them. And that's a one-way transmitter. So they don't store data on your critters. They don't do any of that. And in fact, we actually use RFID in a lot more settings today than we ever have. And so if you go to a lot of our, I call them larger, but really they're probably middle-sized dairies. They are utilizing RFID to get their cows bred, to know when their cows are in heat. And they're also using RFIDs in the dairy industry to determine milk production. And so, you know, instead of punching in a number on their milking machines, those cows walk in, the milking machine says, oh, that's cow 52. And here's her production today. And so it helps them keep records. And similarly, in a feed yard, and even in some cow-calf operations, we are using RFID in those technologies in a similar manner. And it's quite frankly really nice to use because many of our scale heads today have a reader within them. So an animal can walk into the chute and you can say she weighs 1,320 pounds, and it can even tell you that they've been gaining this much, and you know, it can tell you a lot of stuff. So there's really a lot of power in that technology. I don't know that the controversy in that technology comes from the technology itself, but when we try to use it in a traceability plan. And I think people are more, at least this is my observation, and maybe I'm wrong, you can tell me if you think I am, that people are more concerned about using it with the traceability system. And, you know, traceability is so important in this country. I sit at the North Dakota Board of Animal Health meetings a couple times a year. And when you hear them talk about, just in North Dakota, the cost and time that it takes for them to trace tuberculosis cases in the state, and we're a state that has very few TB cases. I look in South Dakota where they've had more cases. The amount of time and effort that they spend going through health certificates and brand records, and then in places where we don't have brand, trying to figure out where livestock have gone, it is just darn near impossible. And so when we look at diseases that are even worse than TB and, you know, things like foot and mouth disease, we will have traceability, whether we want it or not. And I would say that it's almost like building resilience into your industry, that you want to have that traceability system in place so we can practice with it a little more instead of trying to figure out where animals have been without having any use, any prior use of that system. On a international note, of our major competitors, we are the only country that does not have a major traceability system. Yeah. And in the international world, and I would say even domestically, that is a major issue with our consumers. They really would like to know a lot about the food that they eat. And you know, I really kind of think that we could improve our management. I think we could improve our marketing, both at the local level, but also on the consumer level, if we had some better, if we utilized the technologies that come with that, not only in traceability, but also in production. And, you know, we were headed towards having maybe more of a mandatory RFID traceability system, and then that has been pulled off the dockets. And so, you know, I think it's one of those things. Is this going to be the hill that our industry dies on? I sure hope not. But, you know, hopefully we never see something like foot and mouth disease. But I would much rather us be prepared for the worst rather than hoping for the best at that point in time.
Yeah. So you would say that from a producer's perspective, the people that are opposed to this, it's the traceability that they don't like. Like, they don't want to be singled out.
I think so. Do you? I mean, that's what I kind of get from it, is that they would prefer not to have the traceability. Now, is they don't want that because of the RFID system? I don't know. You know, the really nice part about it is that we actually have high frequency tags today that are relatively affordable. You can almost run them at a speed of commerce. And if you don't think that that's not true, you try to go anywhere that has a name badge on it and scanners on either side, that is RFID technology, high frequency. That is how they are tracing all of our products through our consumer industry. So, you know, paper towels, even meat, you know, they know where a load of meat is. They know, it is pretty amazing what the consumer side of our industry uses that high frequency work for. But even now, lots of times those synchronization protocols within dairies, they're using a high frequency tag because they have longer reach with it. They're smaller, they're lighter, they're cheaper. And so I think we're getting to the point where we can actually use some high frequency and trace cattle livestock, but in this case, cattle in a larger group instead of one by one. So maybe as they all walk into the auction market ring and walk out and then walk on the truck. You know, I grew up in an auction market, and I can remember taking cattle off a truck because the count wasn't right and trying to figure out where the count was wrong at. And, you know, and so I think that there could be some benefits. It's just we've got to maybe decide that we want to be part of the solution instead of fight about it. And, you know, to people like Larry Schnell's credit at Stockman's and Dickinson, he has really worked hard to see how those things can work in an auction market, and been a part of a lot of research projects involved with that at NDSU.
Yeah, so again, our industry is under a lot of pressure to be efficient and sustainable, and that would maybe be a way to take some of that pressure off.
Absolutely. I would say,
yeah.
I'm sorry?
Nope, I was just agreeing with that. You know, mm-hmm. Taking some pressure off, yep. So obviously, well, both you and I are women working in a male-dominated industry. So could you tell me some of your experiences, good and bad? I'm sure there's both. I have my own. You know, just tell me about some of your stories. I like to hear people's stories.
You know, so when I started with NDSU, I'll back up. So I'm a native of Colorado. I went to Colorado State University. I was actually an interim county agent in Greeley, Colorado for a year. And the way that the system worked in Colorado was that if you were a quote unquote underserved population relative to agriculture, you were pretty much given an interview. And that really made me mad because being a female, there were not a lot of females in agricultural extension at the time. I was, whether competent or not, or deserving, or one of the best candidates, guaranteed an interview. And I hated that. And in fact, when I came to NDSU and Dr. Charlie Stoltenow and Dr. Greg Lardy hired me, I told them, I said, if I ever find out that I was even given once an interview because I'm female, I'm quitting. You don't even get 2 weeks notice because that's not how I do business. I want to be hired because you want me, not me because I'm female.
And you want to stand on your merits and the work you've put in to be there.
Absolutely. And so when I started, you know, there were, I think only four or five of us really in ag extension at NDSU. And, you know, the guys I always thought were great to us. I really loved them. They were so good to me. They were, you know, I think that almost they were like, you know, you're a trailblazer for our daughters and the girls that we work with in 4-H. And even for the most part, the producers have been exceptionally good. You know, I think that when you go into this deal and you say you're authentic, you tell them what you know and tell them what you don't know, and, you know, show that you care. I think it was maybe Teddy Roosevelt at one time that said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. I think that those things all come together. You know, as we've gotten more women in agriculture, my observation is that at least within extension, we've lost a lot of men. And so therefore we don't have what I would say is some good strong male role models for kids in 4-H. We have a tough time finding chaperones, male chaperones for stuff. And so I think in lots of ways, it's just been a way for men to maybe focus their talents on giving back in other areas. And so that's kind of one of the things I see. I enjoy working with men. You know, you kind of don't get all the drama that sometimes comes with women.
I agree.
And not that we have a lot of that in extension, but you know, I think the more women you build together, you kind of get a little more of that drama. It's kind of like running a herd of mares, you know?
It really is.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that comes into play. And then I think men don't always feel as comfortable with that, really. But I don't think I've ever been sexually harassed in any way, you know? And guys have just been really, really good to me, and I can't say enough about it. And you know, my experience has been nothing but wonderful, and I have to say that straight out. And you know, I know for the women who came before me that maybe it wasn't always that way, and so I very much appreciate that, that the paths that they laid out. And you know, the best of the best ended up there in the early days, and I think that you know, to the Jackie Buckleys and Carmel Millers and Loyan Moites, those ladies, they were just phenomenal, and I will always thank them for everything that they've done for me in the state of North Dakota, because, you know, it was easy to walk in behind them or walk in with them and say, you know, we're on this team together. And because the producers, female, male, kids, whatever, parents, they all respected them because they knew that they led with their heart, and came with good intentions and were authentic in what they did.
Yeah, we need those trailblazers. And everyone is, you know, people like to say, oh, I wish we were still living in the good old days. Well, what were the good old days? I'm pretty thankful that I'm 30 years old in 2021, working in the industry I am now, and that I wasn't, that I didn't have to be the trailblazer or the one, you know, to make that path for the women after me.
Absolutely. You know, I am too, to be honest with you. And I kind of have to laugh because I'm an extrovert at the highest level. And, you know, we used to go through pretty rural Colorado, and I always tell my folks, man, I'd love to run cows out there. And my mom, she'd just laugh and say, you would die out here because there's not enough people for you to talk to. But quite frankly, 50 years ago in agriculture, probably, I would have had, if I wanted to be an ag, I would have had to be at home on a farm and ranch. And truly, I don't know that it would have been good for my mental health. You know, yeah. I would have had to be away doing something. And so then I probably would have ended up doing something other than agriculture, which breaks my heart. And so, you know, I think my friend Jerry Yates says that change is inevitable and progress is optional. But you know what? Almost always, if we want to look at that change, it's almost always that we make progress. And so yes. I think it's been a good thing. But yeah. I wish some more men would come back in to, like, teaching ag and extension and those things.
That's really interesting that that's been something that you've observed. I'm yes. a little shocked.
Well, I think if you would even go like to our ag colleges, they would tell you that we're not seeing males show up even in applications to come to school. And in vet schools, you know, we don't have enough men. And, yep. you know, being a large animal veterinarian is not for faint of heart. And, you know, there's always a story that, or a statement that goes, everybody wants to be a cowboy until it's time to do cowboy stuff.
Absolutely.
And everybody wants to be a large animal vet until your body breaks down. And it is a grueling, honestly, very, very physically demanding job. And, you know, what I see go on is that we don't have enough males in large animal practice either. Because my friends who are females, their bodies just give out on them, yep. you know, and pretty soon they just can't do it anymore. And so I think we need some men that are coming back. And I actually ponder often, where are our men going? Or have they just decided not to go to college? Have they decided to go to two-year programs? Have they decided that in order to run a farmer ranch, you don't need to go to school? Well, by and large, yeah, you maybe don't need to go, but boy, most of us learn more after we go and see a different side of the world and are better in business and all those kind of things. And so absolutely. I hope that we haven't decided that men just don't need to leave the farmer ranch and that yeah. they're fine there. So,
yeah. And, you know, to the veterinarian point, there is a shortage of large animal vets. It's, you know, when you live in a rural area, it's tough to find one. And I talked about that actually in another podcast with David Knowles. He works for a yes. vet supply company, and he really stresses the fact that us large animal producers, like, we gotta support our veterinarians because
you do, you absolutely do. And, you know, I guess that's kind of, to me also, I think we have gotten away from using our veterinarians as part of our management team. We yep. only go to them when we're in a wreck. Well, yep. in my life, I would say that we need to have at least two meetings a year with our veterinarians to see what's going on with our management team. The guys on the crop side are doing that with their crop consultants and paying them to do it, right? And right. so why are we not doing that on the livestock side?
Yeah. So Lisa, one last question for you. What's the future of cattle production in the U.S. look like to you? And what's your prediction of how it might change?
Well, you know, change is inevitable and progress is optional, as the yes. story goes. But, you know, I think it's actually really strong. But I think we've got to get ahead of some of these animal well-being issues. We've got to be on the forefront of it. And, you know, telling our story that, you know, our animals are so well cared for. You know, in the dairy business, we actually kind of laugh sometimes, and I'm not a dairy producer, but I love working with our dairy producers. And, you know, one of ours in North Dakota, they have family that produce in Europe, they have family that produce in Canada, and they have family in the dairy business in New Zealand. And I actually laugh because the New Zealand people are now being forced to take their cows out of barns and run them on grass. And I think the European producers are being forced to take their cows off grass and run them in barns. All of that because of whatever the world thinks animal well-being should be. And at the end of the day, I think we can run animals, produce animals great either way, right? And so we need to fund research that shows what good production practices are and how to implement them. Then we need to do our due diligence to implement those and hold the feet to the fire of those in our industry that don't. You know, there's a point in time when we have to say right is right and wrong is wrong. And if you're not living up to the standards of our industry, you need to know that you need to do better. And then I really think that we've got to get ahead of this, whatever we want to call it, sustainability, stewardship on the environmental side. I don't care what the term is. I don't love sustainability, but I think we're stuck with it because it was given to us. And we've got to be at that table every day. And again, we have to support the research and the education that goes with that, so our producers know what the practices are and how to implement them. And, you know, I think that we're probably implementing 80% of them now. So why don't we fund the research to show that we're doing that? And if we're not doing that, I think most of us want to leave this earth better than we landed on it. And so let's fund the research and the education to show what we need to do. And, you know, I'm so thrilled to be... that's okay, to be part of a team at NDSU that look at both the animal well-being and the environmental well-being pieces of those things, the stewardship pieces on both sides. And really, I think we're at the forefront of that. And I just hope producers will not be so scared of those terms and see that we're doing all of this to help them. And to tell our good story, you know, and to continue down those paths to allow us to be successful. I think we have a great future ahead of us. You know, everything shows that China and India and some of these other countries are going to continue to grow in population. And quite frankly, they don't have the land mass to feed themselves. And in China's case, they can't even keep ahead of their swine diseases enough to feed themselves with the largest pork population in the country. And you know, they're going through another depopulation run here with African swine fever. Now that has moved into the confinement barns in Europe. And, you know, our good biosecurity and all of us need to be implementing it in this country, and traceability will allow us to stay in those markets and be the producers for the world, plus our country. And, you know, our country is awfully spoiled to have a cheap, safe food supply. They really are. And, you know, when you go to some other countries, they spend so much of their money on food, they don't have enough money to buy luxury items. And so we're pretty blessed to be able to do that.
Yeah, Americans, we spend the least amount of money on our disposable income on food. So I think that's something to hang our hat on, especially Absolutely. For farmers and ranchers. But Lisa, thank you so much for taking
May
time.
May I say one last thing, Jeff?
Yes, absolutely.
And producers, I know you're going through tough times. I hope you don't think that I don't know that, because we all are, okay? If you need to talk to somebody, please talk to them. Every one of you is important to our industry. Every one of you is important to your community. And most importantly, every one of you is important to your family. And so if that stress is getting to you, please talk to somebody. Our phones are on. We're here to listen. There's no judgment in us, you know, that we're here to listen. And so whether that means that you get some counseling help or you just talk through with your priest or your minister or whoever that is and your clergy, or you talk to a community member or somebody in extension, whoever that is, get some help, okay? You are the most valuable asset we have, period. And when you're gone, who do we find to fill those shoes? And so we're here for you. Please take care of yourselves mentally, you know. Do a mental checkup on yourself. I always tell producers that, you know, we worry about the health of our crops and the health of our livestock, but we don't worry about the health of ourselves. And so take care of yourselves and take care of each other. We're here for you.
Yes, exactly. And folks like yourself are the reason why I love agriculture and why I choose to continue to work within this industry. So thank you again for your knowledge, your wisdom, your research, everything that you do, Lisa. I really appreciate you coming on here. for us thank at you. The network here. So we will talk to you soon.
Yes, thank you.